League play against the Brewers.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is out today.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, millions of seniors could get some relief at the drug counter under a new bipartisan plan forged by a Senate committee and being discussed today. The $400 billion proposal would represent the most radical restructuring ever in Medicare's four-decade history. Under the plan, the government would pay half the cost of a senior citizen's prescription drugs, up to $3,450 a year. The agreement, which has not been endorsed by President Bush, rejects one of the key tenets of Bush's Medicare plan, drug subsidies for patients who join private plans. Well, joining us to discuss the Senate plan and its future is Dr. Robert Blendon, a professor of health policy and political analysis at the Harvard University School of Public Health. Welcome, Dr. Blendon.
Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. While the plan, doctor, would give seniors some relief, you know, the figures still appear to be outside the means of some seniors, a $35 per month fee, a $275 yearly fee, and a benefit cutoff in the mid-$3,000 a year range. How many people would benefit by all this?
I think it'll be an improvement for many seniors, but it will be a disappointment, just like you described it. This is not the standard insurance that people who work get, where they just pay $10 or $15 out of pocket for every prescription. This has retirees paying a lot of the bills, and I think they're going to be disappointed about this. At the same time, we're almost 4 years since politicians of both parties said to people who are retired, we're going to help you with your drug costs, and nothing's happened. So I think there's some sign at least that will be some relief, but there will be a disappointment among many seniors. It doesn't offer the kind of coverage that many of their children have at work. But for people who don't have coverage at all or very limited coverage, it'll be an improvement, even if it disappoints them in terms of what they expected.
So if you have no coverage at all, it might not be a bad thing. And it's certainly a good thing that at this point, senators as divergent as Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts and Senator Frist of Tennessee, usually on opposite ends of the spectrum, both agree this is a good thing. But for a person who's working now and is used to getting drugs, for example, at their pharmacy for $10 or $15, they could retire and have to pay more than that?
Absolutely. I think for them, it's going to be sticker shock.
Do you have a better idea? I don't mean that sarcastically at all. How would you approach it?
The answer has to do with money. So the real issue is whether or not, you know, you defer your tax cut or you stop spending on something else and you try to give retirees a drug benefit more like their working children. We know how to offer a better drug benefit.
It's all about funding and priorities.
Absolutely. I think the thing that has been answered is the president's plan originally was you only got a better drug benefit of any sort if you joined a private HMO or managed care plan. And for people who would stay with Medicare as it is and go to the doctor, they would have hardly have gotten anything. That proposal is now dead. That, I think, is most people will think is an improvement. But without the priority change, there's not enough money here being offered for people to feel that the benefits are adequate.
Now, what happens next? Are we still years away from a coherent Medicare plan, a permanent Medicare plan for our seniors?
My hope is that, and I think that's why it has gotten so much newspaper attention today, there are signs that at least they might be able to reach some agreement and something where people could see within a year some sort of plan offered to retirees. Otherwise, just a few weeks ago, if you were interviewing me, I would say this is stalemated, that we would be looking seniors in the face and saying nothing is going to happen from this Congress. Now I think there's a chance that at least the first step of a benefit could be enacted and people could actually see it happen within a year.
Dr. Robert Blendon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Robert Blendon is a professor of health policy and political analysis at the Harvard University School of Public Health.
The Bush administration is refusing to sign a draft agreement that would make it easier for poor countries to import generic copies of patented medications. That arrangement would have allowed developing countries that do not have their own pharmaceutical industry to import cheap drugs from places like India, China, and Brazil, instead of the more expensive versions of those drugs from manufacturers in the United States and Europe. That agreement was first promised by the World Trade Organization in late 2001, and a year later, 142 of the 143 WTO member nations backed a draft plan. But the United States blocked the proposal, and U.S. trade representatives are now advocating a more limited program to make drugs for some 20 infectious diseases more widely available. The U.S. pharmaceutical industry lobbied against the original arrangement. We'll talk to its representative in just a moment. But first, Nathan Ford, Access to Medicines advisor for Doctors Without Borders, an organization that is critical of the U.S. stand on the issue. He joins us from London. Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Let me ask you first, isn't it enough to take for now half the loaf? I mean, the United States is proposing medicine for 20 infectious diseases to be available. Isn't that at least a good start?
No, it's actually setting up a double standard whereby rich countries that have pharmaceutical manufacturing capacity can make generic medicines whenever they need to, whereas poor countries are being forced in a position to only be able to do it for a limited set of diseases or epidemics, as the language is used. And that ends up setting up a double standard, which was never what the WTO agreements were about.
And what are the consequences of that on the ground in these countries?
Well, that's why Doctors Without Borders is engaging in this debate, because we are seeing the consequences on the ground every single day. We have 400 medical programs in around 85 countries, and we know very, very well that there are a lot of things that need to be done for poor people to access healthcare, but one significant and often predominant barrier to accessing treatment is the cost of medicines. Generic medicines are often a lot more affordable than the brand alternatives. And it's not a case of undermining pharmaceutical companies' profits or piracy or any other problems of that nature. It's simply a case of a patient being given the choice between a brand drug that they can't afford or nothing at all. And we're protecting their rights to have a second alternative, which is to seek generic drugs, which they can afford.
Is the big picture problem here that these are diseases that primarily affect poor people and occur in places that are of little consequence to the global economy?
The big problem really is that the pharmaceutical industry continues a business model of small volume, high price tag. They don't operate like many other manufacturers do, say Coca-Cola, who reduce their prices according to what the market can afford. They still have very, very high prices for their medicines. I'll give you a practical example. In Thailand today, triple therapy for standard age treatment costs around $490 a month for brand drugs and $27 a month for the locally produced generic versions. And I can tell you that very, very few of the million people with AIDS in that country can afford $490 a month for their treatment, but they can afford $27 a month for their treatment. So it's the difference between life and death, the issue of whether or not you can access generic medicines.
Now, if you speak to people in the pharmaceutical industry, they'll tell you that, hey, if generic drugs are made available in Africa, that's going to erode their intellectual property rights and also reduce their incentive to fund and research new treatments. So anything wrong with that argument?
It's absolutely unfounded. Africa currently represents 1% of global pharmaceutical sales. So the pharmaceutical industry isn't making a cent in Africa. Its research and development profits are made in the West and go back into further research for Western-based market diseases.
And what about the intellectual property rights argument?
Well, I don't believe that intellectual property rights are an absolute given. They are rights that are accorded by governments, and every intellectual property system contains safeguards to overcome the problems that market monopolies create. Governments have to be able to overcome patents when they're a barrier to access to healthcare. It's clear in the World Trade Agreements that's allowed. On a national level, governments do it all the time in the West, and developing countries need to be able to access those rights as well.
Nathan Ford is the Access to Medicines advisor for Doctors Without Borders. Thanks very much, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
We turn now to Mark Grayson, a spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association in Washington, D.C. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you today, Gail?
Very well, thanks, and thanks for joining us. I want to ask you about this agreement, because at the time of the Doha meeting, the United States seemed to think that it was a very good idea to loosen patent restrictions, to ease shortages and reduce prices for places like Africa. And then apparently, as a result of some intensive lobbying, the U.S. backed off that idea. What's the problem?
Well, that's absolutely not the case at all. In fact, the matter is, the Doha agreement was a political agreement that everyone said was to try to help the poorest nations in the world have access to pharmaceuticals. And in fact, the matter is, the agreement did that. There was one small part of the agreement to still negotiate. And the U.S. government has just really wants to make sure that it's about the poorest countries of the world. Unfortunately, there are many people out there that are trying to say that it's about all countries of the world. And if that's were the case, the U.S. government, from what I believe they've said, is that the agreement could make it hard for anybody to want to do pharmaceutical research because it would endanger innovation all over the world and not just for the poorest people.
Well, then why not restrict these sales to those poorest countries rather than restricting drugs sort of across the board?
Well, that's exactly what we would like to do, but unfortunately Doctors Without Borders and others do not want it restricted just for the poorest countries. They are trying to have it opened up for every country of the world, which would, as I said, would take away the benefits of any intellectual property. And if it were about the poorest country of the world, the United States would have signed on, and this would have been done the next day.
But isn't the United States sort of the 800-pound gorilla here? I mean, if that's really what they wanted, why wouldn't they be able to get it?
Well, the WTO is a consensus organization, so it has to be every single country has to agree.
Mark, let me ask you about the really big picture here, because you have to wonder, isn't it in the best interest of everyone, including the United States, if the world is a healthier place? I mean, Americans travel. We've seen this with SARS. Sick countries and poor countries are also additionally often home to terrorism. Shouldn't we be trying everything that we can possibly do to make certain that globally people are healthy?
Exactly. We agree 100%. We would like everybody to have access to medicines as best that they can. When people don't have enough money to buy medicines, it's not because there are patents. And in fact, the matter is, almost all the essential drugs that the World Health Organization has on their list don't have any patents at all. So it's not the patents that are keeping people from getting their medicine. That's the first thing. But the second is, if you don't have some kind of patent protection around the world, you will be stuck with the medicines that currently exist, so that if you have a SARS and you have other kinds of things that come about, there won't be an opportunity for people to come up with a cure for those particular diseases.
Thank you so much, Mark.
I appreciate it very much.
Mark Grayson is a spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association in Washington, D.C. Just ahead, a simple walk in the woods that is a walk through the whole universe, too.
And later in the show, Ken Loach's new not-so-sweet film, Sweet 16.
There's more coming up here and now. This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Epson, makers of the Stylus CX5200, the only all-in-one with DuraBright inks for images that resist damage from water, light, and smudges, available at local retailers and Cipal Restaurant in Watertown, home of the falafel sandwich. This is WBUR.
The WBUR online auction continues through Tuesday, but your chance to bid on Peter Gabriel tickets ends at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
I hear that voice again.
Tomorrow morning at 9 is the deadline to bid on tickets to see Peter Gabriel in a rare live performance at the Tweeter Center on June 18. Visit the online auction at WBUR.org and make a bid for the news.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
William Blake wrote of finding a universe in a grain of sand, Well, for 39 years, Ched Ramos found the universe in his daily mile-long walk from his home in northeastern Massachusetts to Stonehill College, where he teaches. It's a pretty ordinary walk in the woods. But as Chet's new book, The Path, reveals, for those who know how to look, everything is extraordinary. Recently, I joined Ched Ramos on his walk along The Path.
I think it was John Ruskin that said, the greatest thing a person can do is pay attention to what one sees and then describe it plainly. And I think that's what I've tried to do on The Path.
What I see is a kind of muddy path. Trees, mostly with fairly new leaves on them. It's still late spring, early summer at best. What do you see, Chet, that I might not be seeing?
Well, for example, here are the first little woodland wildflowers of the season, the Canada Mayflower, spreading its two little green leaves to try to catch some of that almost non-existent sunlight.
You'll make a connection to this tiny, delicate little plant and that sun, even if obscured by cloud, 93 million miles away.
I do. In fact, I start with this little plant and follow it up into the sky, back to the center of the sun, to where it's produced by nuclear fusion at the center of the star, making that connection between what's happening right here on the side of the path and what's happening throughout the universe at the centers of all the stars in the universe.
When I asked you if you saw something that I didn't see, I was impressed by how immediately you dipped down and found this tiny little flower that chances are wouldn't have even noticed. What else do you see?
Well, the first ferns. Birds are, of course, singing. There's a beautiful little object. Any idea what that is?
You just dipped down and picked up kind of a little green ball with sort of brown spots on it.
This is a oak gall. This is made by a little insect that inserts its egg in the oak leaf. And inside here, we'll find the little larva of the insect. There he is.
Inside, it's mostly hollow, but it's got a small kind of star-like, kind of a feathery thing that's got a little yellow center surrounded by little...
Well, there's the little larva in the
center. That's the larva.
There he is in the center, and he will use this for nourishment and protection until it's time to drill a little hole and make his escape later in the season.
And what will come out of that?
I think it's a gnat that makes this particular gall.
Lots of
different insects make different galls, but it represents a relationship between the insect and the plant that goes deep, deep into geological time.
You see a woods that's in constant motion, trees move in the wind and birds flit across our sight, but you also talk in the book about the motion that's within all things, the molecular motion. Everything is...
Every cell of this gall, the DNA is spinning, weaving proteins, correcting errors. When you know about what's going on in every cell of our bodies, in every cell of every plant, at every moment, as the DNA is ceaselessly spinning out new proteins, you get that sense of the whole world animated around you. But even the land we're standing on, these rocks right here that we're walking across on the trail, these all came from somewhere north of here and were dropped here by glaciers 10 to 15, 20,000 years ago. We could follow the path of the glaciers back to the north and find a place where every one of these rocks was plucked off the bedrock surface of the earth, brought here by the ice, and dumped. That's motion, too.
Nothing here doesn't have its own story and isn't part of a much larger story.
And what's astonishing, when you start looking at those stories, when you start tracing, for example, the gall or the Canada Mayflower, and learn their stories, you start realizing that all the stories are somehow connected.
But we're all separate, aren't we?
That's one of the great mysteries, isn't it? None of us, you or I, exist independently of all this. I mean, we're connected to it in an infinite number of ways. And yet there is something uniquely individualistic about each of us. And the real balance, I think, or the real challenge in life for any of us is finding that balance between our own individuality and our participation in this larger world around us.
Which could make you worry about the world right around this refuge, this forest, this landscape that we're in right now. Not very far from here, there are highways jammed with cars, each car with a few people in it, out of touch for the most part, with what you're so in touch with every morning on your simple walk?
Well, it's a question that all of us have to find an answer to. To what extent is it necessary for us to stay somehow in contact with the larger natural world? All of us, are myself included, are creating artificial virtual worlds around us. We're approaching a little bridge here, what I call in the book the plank bridge. In the winter, you walk by this pond, and you'd swear that there's nothing alive here. It's frozen over. But under that ice, down there in the mud, all of that life is waiting for a rebirth in the spring, and it's glorious when it actually occurs.
There's a lot more in the ordinary backyard of anyone than most people probably realize.
It's an important part of this book that my path, this 1 mile, this 3,000 paces, is in some ways absolutely commonplace. That leads to the story I'm telling. The stories that I spin out of what I see along this path are stories of our Earth, of our universe. They're stories that we all share. And so although to me this particular 3,000 paces is very dear and very precious indeed, it could be anyone's 3,000 paces.
Science writer Chet Ramo. His new book is called The Path, A One-Mile Walk Through the Universe.
Here's a nice little discovery I made the other day. The Phoebe nest.
Phoebe is a bird.
Phoebe is a bird. Absolutely.
With us, there's more ahead, here and now. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gentle Giant Moving and Storage Company, winner of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce 2002 Small Business of the Year Award and the Better Business Bureau's 2003 Local Torch Award. By Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroke.com. And by the Boston Bean Coffee Company, purveyors of fine coffee, equipment, and service to the workplace, and exclusive distributor of Pete's Coffee and Teas. Information at 1-800-448-BREW. 74 degrees right now in Boston. This is WBUR.
What makes the Citizens of the World Tour special?
These trips are very well organized, but very flexible at the same time. What makes them special is the contacts that have been made for us and the imagination that was used in arranging the trips. It was top class.
Join Sylvia Pagioli on our next Citizens of the World tour and travel off the beaten path, exploring the countryside and cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria this summer. Learn more about the trip and sample wines from the vineyards of Tuscany and Umbria at a free reception this Monday. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community. On the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, coming up, resignations at the New York Times, new ownership rules from the FCC. Our editorial roundtable weighs in.
And British social realist Ken Loach's latest film, Sweet 16, offers a grim look at teenage life in working-class Glasgow.
Pinball, that's the best sight you can ever imagine.
I'll be having that sight soon, don't worry.
I can wish.
Now that is English. Thankfully, the film is subtitled.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. The Islamic militant group Hamas is refusing to discuss a halt on attacks against Israelis with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. A Hamas leader says that's because the prime minister made too many concessions in last weekend's summit with President Bush and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Abbas had planned to meet with the Hamas leaders this weekend. The UN's chief weapons inspector is voicing doubts about the quality of the intelligence used in the search for banned weapons in Iraq. Hans Blix tells the BBC his team went to several sites on the advice of intelligence sources, but found nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. Blix says he was assured he was working with the best intelligence available. A team of UN nuclear experts is back in Baghdad today. Members of the International Atomic Energy Agency will assess the damage at Iraq's largest nuclear facility. The UN inspectors, who will be closely monitored by the U.S., have been given 2 weeks by the Pentagon to evaluate damage done by looters at the plant. It's now up to the House of Representatives to decide whether to expand the child tax credit to benefit low-income families. The Senate voted yesterday in favor of the measure, following an intense Democratic push to help millions of families making less than $26,000 a year. The tax package must reach the president's desk by June 23rd for low-income families to get checks, along with 25 million middle-income households set to receive an advance refund of the child tax credit. The national unemployment rate is at its highest point in 9 years, at 6.1% in May. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao says there are still reasons to be optimistic about the economy.
The May unemployment rate of 6.1%, while disappointing, was pretty much in line with market expectations. And some may even say that a 0.1% uptick is statistically insignificant.
The industries suffering job losses include manufacturing, transportation, and government, while construction, education, and health services say they have increased hiring. The world of horse racing has its eyes on the Belmont Stakes tomorrow. 3-year-old thoroughbred Funnyside goes for the Triple Crown in his native New York. If he wins, he'll be the first Triple Crown winner in 25 years. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are generally up. The Dow is up 90 points at 91.30. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. And by Mississippi's. Mississippi serves individuals, corporations, and community organizations throughout Metro Boston. In the forecast this afternoon, mostly sunny, highs near 80. Tonight, clear and in the 50s. Tomorrow, a chance of afternoon showers with temperatures in the low 70s. Sunday, that chance of showers lingers through the morning with highs in the low 70s. 74 degrees right now in Boston. WBUR supporters include Sipal Restaurant in Watertown, home of the falafel sandwich, selected as one of 16 sandwiches nationwide for the PBS show titled Sandwiches You Will Like. And by the Capitol Steps, performing their newest political musical satire at the Copley Theater, June 17th through the 22nd. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster and Bostix, CapitolSteps.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is away.
Oh, she is, unfortunately. But we're happy to have you, Gail. It's here and now.
Listen to the sound of media conglomeration.
One endangered his family when he testified against the Ku Klux Klan. The other was paid for every new Klansman he recruited. They may soon meet on Capitol Hill.
Commentary like this from the Sinclair Broadcast Group is aired on local TV stations across the country. It's billed as local news, even though it's produced out of a studio in Baltimore. And there could be more and more of it now that the Federal Communications Commission has voted to let media companies own more television stations and newspapers, especially in larger cities. Of course, that's not the only big media story of the week. The resignations of two top editors of the New York Times yesterday caused shockwaves that are still reverberating in newsrooms across the country. Here to talk about it all are members of our editorial roundtable, Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Maine, a Bluthen family newspaper which owns the Seattle Times and other smaller newspapers in Maine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Gail.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, which is owned by the Pulitzer Company, which runs 13 smaller newspapers. Hello, Randy.
Hello, Gail.
And special guest John Sturm is with us today. He is president and CEO of the Newspaper Association of America. Hi, John.
Hi, Gail.
First of all, I'd like you to weigh in on the resignation of the New York Times executive editor, Howell Raines, and the managing editor, Gerald Boyd. Of course, we all know that this began about 5 weeks ago when reporter Jason Blair resigned for plagiarism and fabricating stories. You know, journalists are often quick to point out ethical lapses in others, and I'm wondering, did Raines and Boyd have to step down for the Times to preserve its own credibility? Bill, you want to start with that?
Well, I think there certainly is kind of a siege mentality at the New York Times right now. There's no question about it. But the fact remains that this kid, Jason Blair, was coddled, protected, encouraged by the very people who have now resigned. I mean, whether they had to resign or not, I think goes to some much deeper politics in the New York Times newsroom. I think there's, as I said, I think there's a bit of an insurrection going on there right now.
Randy, what's your take?
It's been pointed out that the Times is one of the few big newspapers that lacks a reader advocate, also called an ombudsman. And I think that reflects the culture. It doesn't want to look at itself too critically or admit mistakes. It has people at the top that don't listen to those at the bottom. And maybe it takes the top people to go to really change the culture of the newsroom.
Well, let's turn now to media ownership, which is another big topic of the day. The Times owns a lot of newspapers, 8 TV stations, 2 radio stations, and, of course, there are other big media companies like Viacom and News Corporation, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Those can now get even bigger if they want to. So, Bill and Randy, neither of your owners also has TV stations. Is that a good thing?
Well, here in Portland, the irony is that the newspaper for which I work once did own a television station and, in fact, also owned a radio station. And over the course of the 70s and 80s was forced to divest those properties. They are now owned by big conglomerates. I get worried when I see major corporations coming in and paying huge amounts for local newspapers. And then my primary concern is that they then cut back on a lot of the resources in order to recoup some of the cost of that purchase.
Randy, how about where you are?
Well, my concern working in a small market is there are good small family chains, and the bigger the chain, unfortunately, it tends to squeeze out the smaller papers in that market. I've seen how it works in some of the metropolitan markets where the combination of a big metropolitan daily and a TV station puts so much muscle into the market that the smaller suburban papers really feel the hurt. And I'm concerned about that if now, in fact, more papers can combine with TV stations.
John, what's your overall take on the new media rules? You think this is a good idea?
I do. I think those rules were made for a time that has long since passed. Certainly the ban on newspaper ownership of broadcast stations was coming from the early 70s, and it doesn't make sense anymore. And the FCC found that newspaper-owned broadcast stations do more and better news and public affairs than any other stations. They found that, and the independent study done by the Pew Center in Journalism also found the same thing.
So if these gigantic companies basically start playing Pac-Man all over the country and gobbling up smaller stations, smaller newspapers everywhere so that there are perhaps eventually only 5 big media companies, that's
Gail,
a good thing?
Hang on a second, Gail. The 5 big media companies that are always knocked around in this debate, there's one newspaper owned by one of those companies, what I would call the renegade New York Post, is owned by Mr. Murdoch, who said publicly that he has no interest in acquiring other newspapers. I don't see anybody not in the newspaper business today gobbling up newspapers in the future, because irrespective of this rule, they could have done so in the past, and they don't.
Why don't they?
The newspaper business is totally different than the broadcasters. There was a quote the other day in one of the newspapers from the fellow that runs Sinclair Broadcasting, since we started that way. He said you might as well be in the trucking business. Broadcasting and newspapers, he felt, were totally different.
Bill, you have a Sinclair television station in Portland. We heard an excerpt from one of their programs as we began. It's something called Central Casting. What's been your response as you watch it? Is it a good program? Well done?
Well, Gail, until recently, I wasn't quite sure what I was watching. You can be looking at your local station, thinking you're watching your local news, and then intermittently, in effect, you are not. and the set might look the same, and the transitions are seamless from the local studio to central casting and back. But it concerns me a little bit in that viewers are not getting exactly what they think they're getting. If a guy can stand there in front of a weather map and say, here in Flint, Michigan, when in fact he's in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, isn't that a lie?
Well, some might think it is. I mean, it could be the same lie, perhaps, as, you know, the dateline filed by the reporter who wasn't really there.
Which is what Jason Blair is accused of doing, among other things.
I'm not saying it's, you know, I don't think it's going to shake journalism to its foundation, but I do think that these little lies have a cumulative effect over time.
So, Bill, my sense of markets where newspapers own TV stations is that the TV news is frankly aided or better when the newspaper is contributing some kind of resource to the newscast. That's something to keep in mind, even though we may be getting remote weathercasts.
We have to wrap up this part. I want to turn to Bill, though, for a final preview of a story that you are hot on the trail of, Bill. You're looking for a limo driver who really upset Martha Stewart.
Well, you know, Martha's in the news these days, Gail. I'm up in Bar Harbor as we speak, because you might recall a couple of years ago, this poor limo driver had a bachelorette party in his limo, and he claims he took a wrong turn into Martha's driveway, and Martha boxed him in, detained him for an hour until the cops came and wanted him prosecuted. The DA finally said no, but in view of recent events, I thought it might be interesting to chat with the limo driver and see how he feels about what he's hearing in the news these days.
He probably thinks it's a good thing. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gail.
Nice being with you.
Thank you, Gail.
John Sturm is president and CEO of the Newspaper Association of America. Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff. And Bill Nemitz is a columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Maine.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's certainly serious business when a CEO cheats shareholders or lies about company earnings or charges to the company an impressionist painting his wife really wanted for her living room. Now, in the past few years, CEOs in stunning numbers have been ending up in jail for that sort of thing. But a new book points out that the clink may not necessarily be what you think. It can be, it turns out, a rather fulfilling experience and a chance to make new friends. Well, joining us on the line now to explain is Andy Borowitz. He's the author of Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison. Welcome, Andy.
Hello, Bill.
First off, I guess the whole idea here is simply to make hard time a little bit softer.
Absolutely. You know, if time is money, then hard time is cold cash. That's what we're saying here. I'm really trying to poke fun at a serious topic here, but it's actually turning out to be kind of a helpful book because of what's happening to people like Sam Waxel and, of course, Martha Stewart. I mean, I do think that, you know, we have a problem, a crisis in our country because we have all these business school programs that, you know, spend 2 years teaching students how to get to prison, but there's absolutely nothing to show them what to do once they get there.
What's the title mean, the soap part?
Well,
Who Moved My Soap?
Who Moved My Cheese was a very popular title, as we know.
That's right.
You know, a business guide. It's all about adapting to change in the workplace. And, you know, soap is kind of a good metaphor for prison because soap and prison showers is kind of a fairly iconic image in prison.
Now, there are some things about going to prison if you're a CEO that don't come completely as a shock, right? I mean, one of your chapters is called Replacing One Gated Community for Another.
Exactly. Well, what I point out is, you know, CEOs live in mortal fear of going to prison, and yet so much of the corporate life is already prison-like. I mean, how many times does a CEO talk about how he's all tied up in the office or he's chained to his desk and he can't get free? These are really things that you would really associate more with prison. I point out that in prison, you're actually not living that kind of chained up sedentary lifestyle. You're always on the move, you know, because you're always sort of dodging things that might be flying at you.
particular relevance as we speak. In fact, I'm looking at a television monitor as we speak with her on it. Martha Stewart, you were thoughtful enough to include a chapter specifically for female CEOs. You call it Breaking the Concrete Ceiling.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
Well, you know, I didn't want to be accused of sexism. I didn't want to deal just with the problems of male CEOs, because as it turns out, the most famous CEO in the world who's facing possible prison time now is a woman, Martha Stewart. And so it would be very unfair not to include something about that. I think that they have a separate set of problems. I mean, I think, for example, a male prisoner who might, you know, start a prison riot or be violent is considered kind of a tough customer and is given a lot of respect, where a woman who does the same thing behind bars is considered maybe shrill and sort of somebody you look down upon. So there's a real double standard going on. And I think that female CEOs behind bars really deserve the same respect that we give male CEOs behind bars. We'll never get our money back from these guys, but we might get our sense of humor back. And they've done so much at our expense. Let's have some laughs at their expense for a change.
Andy Borowitz, thanks a lot for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you, Bill.
The book is Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison.
Stop playing cards and a shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 in Wayland, for 127 years offering annuals, perennials, planters, statuary, garden ponds, and gardening professionals. By Flora Restaurant, serving seasonal menus created by Chef Bob Sargent using local farm products, florarestaurant.com or 781-641-1664. And by the Boston Early Music Festival and Exhibition, June 9th through the 15th, presenting music of the German Baroque and the fully staged opera Ariadne. Tickets at bemf.org. The WBOR online auction is underway. It's your chance to bid on hundreds of items, including a project management evening certificate program from Boston University Corporate Education Center and a two-hour consultation and oriental rug from Noor Oriental Rugs. Go to WBUR.org and make a bid.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
British director Ken Loach has been making bold, socially conscious films about the working class poor for almost 40 years. His characters, often played by amateur actors, struggle with their hardscrabble lives, trying desperately to piece together a measure of happiness with a measure of dignity. Loach's latest effort, Sweet 16, is no different. The main character, Liam, is a Scottish teenage delinquent trying to create a home for his family. His addict mother is in jail on a drug charge, and Liam's determined to do whatever it takes to buy her a house after she's released on the day before his maybe not so sweet 16th birthday.
Where's this?
It's a kind of money.
It's Earl, it's a dad of mine, but...
No councils, no banks, it's Earl, ma'am. Earl's. I bought it.
This must have cost a fortune.
I'm getting paid a fortune.
How much are you getting paid?
Don't you worry about that. I've already paid the deposit and the first instalment.
Looks lovely, doesn't it?
No data noise, no junkies, no bogus. Just me and you. And Chantelle and Callum, if they want. There's plenty of room in it. All you need to do is sign for it, ma'am.
As you heard, the Scottish accents are pretty heavy. So heavy, in fact, that director Loach included subtitles. Our guest reviewer this week knows a lot about Ken Loach. Ted Barron is the assistant curator at the Harvard Film Archive and is putting together a summer film program including the work of Loach. Thanks a lot for coming in, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, we're happy to welcome Here and Now's film reviewers, Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer, also here to talk about Sweet 16. Hi.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, guys. Ted, let's start with you. You taught a film class on British social realism at Tufts University. You're a big fan of Loach's filmmaking. Talk a little about who he is, his background, where he stands in British cinema, how this film fits in with his body of work. He's nearly or beyond 70, isn't he?
He's getting there. He came of age around the time of when the British New Wave, which had sort of come to prominence in the late 1950s and early 1960s was just a, sort of reaching its crest and starting to fall off. His first film that he made was actually for the BBC, a film called Kathy Come Home. And it was a story about a homeless teenage girl. And it's an interesting work in that it mixes documentary and fiction techniques. And it was so powerful and had such a strong connection with the audience that it actually led to some legal reform in England. Following that period, he sort of languished, continuing to work for the BBC, but making films that were almost sort of too controversial in the sense of he made a film about striking minors, which the political stance was so strong that it just became too much for the BBC to get behind that. So many of his films basically went unseen for a good part of the decade and into the 80s.
Now, where does this film, Sweet 16, fit into the larger body of his work?
I would call it sort of a return to form for Loach, because around the time of the early 90s, where he starts to have sort of a comeback, he was making films that, such as Raining Stones and Riff Raff, which were films that blended sort of more humorous elements of life in trying to sort of capture the everyday with his stronger political stances.
Eric, Ted said that some of his latter-day films had been a little lighter than some of the earlier films, but this is certainly no typical teen film, is it?
No, it's certainly not typical if we think about Hollywood teen films, which are usually, you know, set in the middle or upper classes, and they're usually, you know, imbued with some sense of fun where we, you know, have to go out and, you know, lose our virginity or fix Dad's Porsche because we've wrecked it or something like that. You know, since we are dealing with the lower classes here, and since we're dealing with a very different milieu, you know, set in Glasgow, this film is much different. Part of it is from that sense of naturalism. You know, this film, the rhythms, the look of it seem very real. And the fact that Loach is using basically non-actors or first-time actors in this film gives the movie a real sense of spontaneity and a real texture that, you know, you don't come near in most Hollywood movies.
It's such a level of realism. You almost feel at times like you're watching a documentary.
Liam, look at me. You're going to sort yourself out?
Aye.
Promise me.
I mean, it has this title that sounds like it should star, you know, Jason Biggs and Mandy Moore and have a soundtrack by Good Charlotte. But you know pretty early on that this film is going to end in tears, and it has to. Anything less would be really emotionally dishonest.
One of the things that is nice about this movie is the fact that he uses music very sparingly. Typical Hollywood film, you'd have an Eminem song or a Blink 182 song every 5 minutes so you could sell a soundtrack. And so that lack of music or, you know, the way in which it's used within a scene adds to the real naturalism of the movie.
Renee, non-actors, that's a risky strategy. Does he pull it off?
Completely. There's not a false moment in this movie. The people look real. They're not beautiful. They have bad skin. They have bad teeth. They look like the characters they're really playing, because in some places they probably are the characters they're playing. This is not a kind of film Hollywood could have made. You can't have sort of beautiful, glammed up, you know, Brad Pitt looking people running around trying to play teenagers. The teenagers actually are teenagers.
What sort of fuss about? But he's ordained. He's gone.
She there?
Where?
Oh,
there
she is.
Let him go. Come on.
Yeah, and I think it's also something that Loach has been doing for a long time. He's frequently used non-professionals in his work, and I think one of the reasons why this is one of his more successful films, other than some of his films he's made over the past couple of years, is that he's returned to that choice rather than use more well-known actors.
Eric, how do you feel about the subtitles? They're speaking English of a manner of speaking.
It's actually very helpful to have the subtitles. I think you'd probably miss about half of the film, you know, because of these very heavy brogues. So the subtitles are actually very helpful, and they're not distracting at all.
Because they're so necessary.
You get any lenses on them glasses? We saw a fuss about you.
I know you're stunning, man. Pinball, that's the best sight you can ever imagine.
I'll be having that sight soon, don't worry.
I can wish.
As you'll be mine.
Yeah, okay. Say something.
I mean, the crux of the story is this kid, Liam. He's 15 years old. His mother is in jail, as you mentioned, and all he really wants to do is earn enough money to buy a trailer home for her where he can live with her. What's interesting in their relationship is because she's such a ne'er-do-well, she's been a drug addict, she's in prison, he's really more of a parent to her than she's ever been to Liam or his sister Chantal, who Liam lives with. What's interesting is he doesn't encourage her drug use, but when he needs to make money to get this trailer, he sells drugs. And it's not because, you know, he's choosing between selling drugs and getting a better job. There simply is no other alternative. And I like the fact that the movie doesn't deal with, there's no dilemma. That's what people in his community do, and he just does it.
And that's one of the things that's also refreshing about this movie is the fact that, you know, it's dealing with the drug issue in a very matter-of-fact way. It's neither glamorizing it nor is it demonizing it. The other nice thing about the movie is that, you know, you have these sort of inklings of an attraction, a bit of a romance potentially between Liam and a friend of his sister's, Suzanne, but it never really goes anywhere. And that's kind of nice. You know, we've got this kid who's 15. He really is in this in-between place. He's between being an adult and a kid, and he doesn't really know what to do. And so, you know, Loach has not felt the necessity to play this up.
Renee, it sounds like, for lack of a better word, a bit of a downer, but you liked it.
It's bleak, but it's a fascinating and remarkable movie. Definitely one of the best films I've seen this year.
Wow. Eric?
Yeah, I'd agree completely. You know, and it's not a total downer. The film actually starts out in kind of a lighter, more playful way, and it does get more serious as it goes along, but it's not as grim and completely dark as some movies might be.
Ted, you've already said it's one of his best.
It is. I mean, I think one of the reasons why is that he's still able to find these sort of nice little moments between individuals. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the film is when Liam is shaving for the first time and his sister and her friend walk in to sort of laugh at him as he's sort of trying to assert some kind of masculinity, which isn't there. But because he's able to find those moments in the film, I think it works very well.
Worth seeking out. Ken Loach's new film, Sweet 16. Ted Barron, thanks very much for joining us. Our guest reviewer this week, assistant curator of the Harvard Film Archives, Renee Graham, thanks for joining us, Renee.
Thanks, Bill.
Pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe, and Eric Schaefer. Eric, thanks for coming in.
You bet, Bill.
Film historian who teaches at Emerson College.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at software. Information on the web at